From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. You start off thinking your child's life is in your hands. Then that child starts to grow and may become a stranger to you. Rose Ellen Brown writes about this in her new novel, Before and After. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about families and their existential crises with Rose Ellen Brown. Also, 35 million Americans don't have health insurance. We'll find out about health care reform on the state level. We'll talk with Trish Riley, Executive Director of the National Academy for State Health Policy. And TV critic David Bianculli has a look at the fall season, and what he sees isn't pretty. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The African National Congress says it's ready to accept South African President F.W. de Klerk's invitation to a summit meeting on political violence if it can produce concrete results. No summit date is set, but ANC officials say they're willing to start planning immediately. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Johannesburg.
The ANC's decision revives hopes that the white minority government and the country's main black political movement will eventually resume constitutional talks on South Africa's future. The ANC broke off those talks in June, in part to protest lack of government action to curb violence. The summit meeting proposed by de Klerk yesterday would focus on violence, including Monday's shooting deaths of 28 ANC supporters who were part of a protest march on the black homeland of Ciskei. The ANC said it still wants to see some government action on violence before the summit, but ANC officials are optimistic that the meeting will take place, with delegations headed by de Klerk and ANC President Nelson Mandela. I'm Ann Cooper in Johannesburg.
Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin said today that his country is prepared to return some of the Golan Heights to Syria in exchange for peace. It was the first time that an Israeli leader has made such an explicit offer of territory in an area that Israeli officials have claimed is essential to their security. Rabin said that Israel would be prepared to make some sort of territorial compromise in exchange for a treaty that would include diplomatic relations and open borders. Although the United States has offered American warplanes to protect food convoys in Bosnia, administration officials said today that such an operation is unlikely in the near future. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Relief efforts in Bosnia are being fired on more often. Secretary General Boutros Ghali is asking the United Nations to send up to 6,000 more troops to protect the food convoys. Despite these developments, the word from Washington is that U.S. warplanes will not offer air cover anytime soon. In an interview with Reuters and the Associated Press, Acting Secretary of State Lawrence Eagleburger said the use of American warplanes was not being seriously considered, although he said it's obviously something on occasion we talk about. It's a future possibility, he said, but we're not there yet. Another U.S. official who asked not to be named said because the U.S. has been the instigator of many of the sanctions against Serbia, quote, there is some reluctance on the part of other countries to have us directly engaged because they feel we would become very quickly a target and this would imperil their people as well. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
Stock prices closed sharply higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 34 points to close at 3,305. Advances led declines by a margin of nearly 2-1. This is NPR. A new survey shows that Democratic challenger Bill Clinton now has a substantial lead over President Bush in the race for electoral votes. Republican strategists had hoped to put the president over the top in electoral votes, even if he fell behind in the overall popular vote. The latest poll by the Field Institute shows, however, that the president has failed to gain a definitive advantage in a single state. The nationwide survey puts the Arkansas governor ahead of the president in 17 states and found that voters were leaning toward Clinton in 15 others. State Farm Insurance, the largest auto and home insurer in Florida, says damage from Hurricane Andrew is twice as bad as initially estimated. So far, claims in South Florida total $1.5 billion, but flood damage is less than anticipated. From Miami, NPR's Kathy Lohr reports.
State Farm officials say they've processed 110,000 claims for damage in South Florida and paid out more than $300 million so far to cover living expenses and other costs. State Farm's regional vice president called Hurricane Andrew the greatest catastrophe challenge in the company's 70-year history. About 2,200 claims representatives are already working in Florida. 400 more adjusters are on their way. Meanwhile, the administrator of the National Flood Insurance Program is cutting the hurricane cost projection from $200 million to just $100 million in Florida and Louisiana. Based on information from nearly 50 private insurance companies, officials say it was primarily wind, not water, that caused the damage. I'm Kathy Lohr in Miami.
A federal court jury decided today that the National Football League illegally restricted the right of free agency for 8 current and former NFL players. The verdict is seen as a decisive one for pro football. The jury found that the NFL's Plan B system of free agency violated antitrust laws. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You know how life can go along day after day with its little ups and downs until suddenly something happens, something tragic, that changes your life forever. It's how these events can unravel the life of a family that interests novelist Rosellen Brown. She's the author of Civil Wars and Tender Mercies. Her new novel, Before and After, describes life in one family before and after the 17-year-old son is accused of murdering his girlfriend. This is a middle-class family in New Hampshire, not used to violence or scandal. The mother is a pediatrician. The father is a sculptor. The murder shocks them into the realization that they no longer know their son. I asked Rosellen Brown to read a section from this new novel after the father finds out his son is probably guilty and the murdered girl was pregnant.
I would have had trouble saying what I thought, that whether he did it or whether miraculously he didn't, I had lost faith in knowing anything. How could it matter what I believed? I couldn't imagine what his head was full of. His memories now were his own. Well, they always had been, of course, only it wasn't so visible. And his motives, too. You start out thinking your child's life is in your hand. You can hold it all right there. He's with you all the time, that little baby. If he plays with friends, you're there. You referee the squabbles. Carolyn and I took turns. If anything, I took some of her turns. You buy the toys, you close him in the yard where he'll be safe, and you think you know the whole cast of characters in his head, the scary parts and the sweet dreams. Only one night he has a nightmare. It rips his sleep in two, and yours as well. You rush in, pull him from his crib as if it's on fire, and comfort him against your shoulder, and he can't tell you a thing. Or a word or two he gives you, a hint, a clue to where the monster came from. Oh, that terrible movie, as if you need Walt Disney to make nightmares. It's huge and hairy, and it was right behind him. Or he fell from a cliff onto the rocks below. Whatever. Where did he get that from? He doesn't watch violence on the tube. He's never had a trauma. Spontaneous combustion is what it is. The little microbes grow in the warmth of his head, that moist medium. Then he matures a little out of eyeshot, down at the daycare where he has experiences you never hear about, little ones too insignificant to report. Ginny pushed him off the swing. Seth gave him his cupcake at lunch. Good, bad, invisible, all of it. The arrogance, the chutzpah. It's his life, even if it's small and hedged by adult watchers. It's his life. But it's a long way from that to knocking up a woman. And a long way, I realized with a shock that was almost electric in its violence, between the young father I was and the grandfather he'd have made me. Would have. Could have, except for death intervening. It rolled over me like a sheet pulled up over my face.
I'm wondering if during the course of writing this or before you wrote it, you ever thought about what your two daughters were capable of and if you ever imagined one of them doing anything as extreme as, you know, the murder that's in the book.
Well, not really. They're a couple of pretty nonviolent kids. On the other hand, of course, the book opened me up to the terrible possibilities that anything could happen in any family. And that was what was it is a little scary about it for me, and I think for my readers, that, of course, the book posits a very ordinary family, and, you know, like my own. And so it's exactly someone like me who thinks, no, my kids are pretty nonviolent, who could, of course, receive a blow like this, because because I'm you know, trying to put forth the idea that almost anything can happen in almost any family. There were in this family, of course, some trouble spots that possibly these parents might have known about, but I think it's gotten very hard for parents sometimes to be able to read what's normal in their children and what's not. And I think I can understand why these people didn't really quite comprehend that their son might be, you know, headed for some kind of problems.
You tend to use real tragedy, real catastrophe, to get at the existential family tragedies that you want to, you know, ultimately write about. Why do you look at real catastrophe? What
draws
you to that?
I think I sort of, in some ways, I guess I kind of use it as a jump start to my imagination. But the reason that I think I do it is that I'm not really all that, this might surprise you, I'm not really all that interested in the actions, in the events. And you never see them directly in my books. They always seem to take place off stage before things start. In Tender Mercies, a woman is accidentally injured in a boating accident. That her husband has inadvertently caused, although what inadvertent means is complicated because his actions arise out of his character. At the end of the autobiography of my mother, a child perishes, I think is the word for it, partly because of the character of her grandmother or a kind of a problem between her grandmother and her mother. And in Civil Wars, which is about a lot of things, post-civil rights novel, really, but one of the things that sort of makes the action go in that book is that two children are orphaned and come to live with, these are two little segregationist children who've grown up in a very bigoted household, come to live with their aunt and uncle who are ex-civil rights workers. And there, too, there's a terrible event that brings them to live with this family. But none of that ever, and in this case, of course, there's the murder. None of this ever takes place on stage. What I'm interested in is the aftermath. I'm interested in how people act after tremendous cataclysms take place in their lives. What happens when ordinary people have to respond to the unexpected? And that simply fascinates me, but the events themselves don't. And so I think that I like to start these books rolling with something large and then watch the very, very tiny increments in which people, you know, which people kind of have to deal with as they go. They're not really plotted books in a sense. They're books that work
more about character.
Yeah, right. And the character works by sort of building up the what ifs. You know, well, what if your son were accused of murder? What would you have to do? First, you would have to deal with, you know, the neighbors calling, and then you would have to deal with the police, and then you would have to deal with, you know, your work. And I kind of, the same thing after Laura is injured in Tender Mercies. What if this happened then? They're really if and then books. I think that's what I'd say.
One of the very big what ifs that you deal with in Before and After is, okay, what if your son was accused of murder?
Right.
And what if you found incriminating evidence? Would you try to destroy that evidence? Would you cover up to save your son? Or would you tell the truth? And
right, that's
a really difficult what if, the kind you could probably only answer if you were in that situation.
I think so. And I think each situation, of course, would differ. What I should tell you that what brought me to this book was a case that took place in Houston quite a few years ago, and the particular details of the crime didn't interest me. I don't read crime books, and I'm not particularly compelled by any of that. But what fascinated me was that in this situation, a boy was accused of murder, and his parents refused to testify against him to bring their evidence to the grand jury. They ended up in jail while he was out on bail. And I was compelled by this because I discovered the reason that they were in jail was that although spouses are protected most of the time from having to testify against each other in court, parents are not. They don't have that privilege. If you have evidence that might incriminate your child and you're called upon to give it, you have to give it. And so in this book, one of these parents goes to jail. The other one chooses a different road and tries to tell the truth.
So in this book, you've kind of made both decisions. I'm sure you've thought about, although it's really impossible
to say. I
haven't.
I've hoped that people would sort of duke it out about which one they, you know, which one they wanted to go along with.
Well, do you know which one you would have chosen? Though I know you can't say, because it's the kind of thing you can only say if you're in this situation.
Yes, I think that's right. No, I really don't. You know, I tried so hard to be even-handed in my thinking and in constructing these characters that I really am not even sure in the end. I think it's in some ways probably best for a novelist, I think anyway, for the kind of novels that I want to write, not to have a clear opinion, because if I did, I would probably shade things one way or another, you know, toward the point of view of one character. I really tried terribly hard to get myself inside the heads of each of these parents as they tried to figure out what was the best way to react. And of course, they are very different in their natural constitutions. Ben, the father, is very impulsive and very, very strong-willed. And Carolyn is a pediatrician and has devoted her life to taking care of children and trying to ease their pain, and is tormented by the question of what she owes to, in a sense, to children, to the dead child, and to the parents of the dead child. So, you know, as they worry out their points of view, each of them really, one of the reasons I can't say what I would do is that each of them works out of his or her own character mm-hmm. and personality.
Your new novel is called Before and After, and it's before and after the murder, before and after the incident that basically threatens to end the family as they know it. And it's really not your first novel that's a before and after kind of novel. There are other novels in which lives are kind of divided by this catastrophe. I have to say, I kind of live in fear that my life will end up a before and after life. And somehow in the after part, I'll look at the things that made me miserable in the before part, and they'll look like the golden days by comparison.
I think that's true. I was just reading an essay yesterday with a class that I was teaching. I'm teaching a class in essay writing in Houston, and we were reading an essay by Nancy Mayers, who's a very good writer, and she was talking about, it's an essay about having adventures, and she talks about how she's redefined an adventure since she's discovered that she has multiple sclerosis. And for her now, an adventure is something very tiny, and it's sufficient. And we spent a lot of time in class talking about whether it should have to take something catastrophic like MS, you know, to bring you to the point where you value small aspects of your life. But I think we all worry about that.
Really, why do you worry about that?
Oh, I believe in the evil eye looking at me. You know, I think I'm probably very primitive in my thinking. I have a feeling that I write these books in which horrors take place. They're not horror books, but horrible things happen. I really do believe that deep down I want to placate some force that I couldn't even name by saying, look, I've already imagined this, so please don't let it happen to me. You know, I've already worked through all of the terrible details, and now maybe I will be exempt from having this kind of thing happen.
Were your parents preoccupied with catastrophe? Was this a big subject at the dinner table?
No, absolutely not. No, a very ordinary, truly an ordinary family. We've never even broken a bone in our, you know, collective, the collective body of the family. I just have an imagination, I guess, that works over time on what could happen. People talk very often about whether we're grateful or not for our ordinary lives, and I think I actually am one of those people who wakes up every day kind of grateful, you know, to be awake another day. I do think about it a lot. Based on nothing in particular. It's just that I look around. I once, when I lived in New Hampshire, which is where this book is set, I once did a little survey on a road near me, up the road a bit. I just went around the block asking myself what I knew about the people who lived in all those houses. And although I'm not a very negative person, I think I have a fairly buoyant personality nonetheless, what I fixed on was that for every one of those houses, I could think of something that was really, you know, a kind of awful fate working itself out. Some of the people would come through, I suppose. This isn't to say that I'm, you know, I don't believe in affirmation, but there was one house in which the father had been arrested for drunken driving, another house in which a terrible cancer was eating up the mother in the household. The third house actually contained two children who had come to this family after an automobile accident not coincidentally the way it happened in civil wars, mm-hmm. because I got the idea from looking at them. Another house in which, well, here was a happy one, actually, an adoption had taken place after many, many years of the families not being able to have their own child, but that was fraught with great pain, even though things ended up wonderfully. So as I went along the road, I was aware of the fact that every household hides some kind of drama, if not tragedy. It doesn't have to be tragic.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Rose Allen Brown. Her new novel is called Before and After. This is Fresh Air. My guest is novelist Rose Allen Brown. I'm wondering what your family was like when you were growing up. Where did you live? What did your parents do?
Well, we moved around a lot in my childhood, and I think this has been a really major factor in my life and in my writing. We moved for no particular reason. Everybody tries to help me out by saying, were you a military brat or something like that? But in fact, it was just coincidental. For example, I started out in your town. I was born in Philadelphia. And people often say, oh, I thought I heard a little Philadelphia accent there. Mm-hmm. But in fact, we moved when I was 10 weeks old. at the end of 10 years that my parents lived there, they were New Yorkers, and they moved there for a job. After that, there were just a succession of moves that, you know, just were the sort of coincidences of my father's work. He was involved in selling textiles and being, you know, nothing particularly exciting in that. But we moved around a lot, and we went from Philadelphia to a couple of Pennsylvania towns, and then to the major part of my childhood I tend to think of as having been lived up in Westchester, sort of working class Mount Vernon, New York, 4 or 5 years. And then we moved to Los Angeles for a year, which was a profound uprooting for me. And then we moved back because that was kind of a failure. We weren't a feckless family. It sounds as if we were. But these were just sort of boring coincidences. But I started writing when we lived in Los Angeles because I found myself in a new school with no friends. And that was the year that I started carrying a little secretarial notebook to school with me and writing stories about girls who woke up on their birthday to find the perfect horse grazing in the yard, you know, the kind of thing that nine-year-old girls are fascinated by, the beautiful horse with the star on its forehead. And I, you know, if I didn't have any other friends yet, I did make them eventually, but I didn't at first, then I could at least be friends with myself by writing in my notebook.
So you were always moving around and not belonging.
Yeah, exactly. And I've tried to write that out. I have only one book in which someone is of the place. I have a book of poems that's a sort of a narrative. It's 84 poems, but they really tell one story in the voice of a New Hampshire woman who is still living in the town that she was born in. And she tries, in fact, to get away. Of course, she's going the other direction. And I wrote that book to see what it would feel like to actually be moored to a place and not be sort of free-floating. But everything else has been an attempt, I think, to write about, you know, what it's like always to feel slightly alienated, really like an outsider.
In the mid-1960s, you spent, during the Civil Rights Movement, you spent a few years in Mississippi teaching, I believe, at Tougaloo College.
That's right.
Yes. And this is an experience you drew on for your novel, Civil Wars. How did you end up there?
Well, it was interesting. I was a Woodrow Wilson fellow in college and graduate school. A girl could be a fellow. Woodrow Wilson at that point, this was mid-60s, decided that they wanted to send some of their old fellows to what they called emerging colleges, which were mostly black and mostly poor. And, you know, we were supposed to sort of go and beef up the curriculum, which had some interesting assumptions built into it, I'd say. But there was plenty of work to be done, of course. And so we wanted very much to take, my husband and I wanted to take part in the civil rights movement in some way. But to be frank, we were really cowardly, and couldn't quite imagine ourselves out on the front lines. That changed fairly quickly when we got there, because the college that we ended up at, Tougaloo, was a real sort of civil rights haven and was much despised in the community. around Jackson, Mississippi. In fact, it was often referred to as Cancer College because it had always been open to civil rights activists and so on, and a lot of the students demonstrated, and we were, in fact, right in the middle of a lot of things when we got there. We taught there for a couple of years, and then my husband went to work for one of the first Head Start programs in the country as the anti-poverty program geared up. And, of course, we discovered that you couldn't stay outside, you know, on the sidelines, and we really didn't want to. In fact, we went there having promised our parents that we wouldn't even ride in what was called a mixed car at the time with blacks and whites together. And 20 minutes on the campus, someone asked if we would drive into Jackson to go to a play. I think they were playing in White America, ironically. And, of course, we said, sure, pile in. And that was the end of that vow, that cowardly vow. So we were very much a part of things for those years. But, of course, there, too, you realize that that was not our movement. I think, you know, whites, of course, were terribly significant in the civil rights movement, but it was not ours. And so it wasn't a place that you went to seeking home.
What did you feel that you most had to contribute to the civil rights movement while you were there and a part of it?
Well, I personally, after my teaching was over, I was writing about it. And I have fought with myself and wrestled over the years, this is really one of my major obsessions, the question that writers like Grace Paley are always asking themselves, how can I be most useful as an activist or as a writer, as a recorder, you know, as a kind of historian of all of this? And in the end, I chose the less active path. I'm not very good at it, and I have decided, and maybe I'm too narcissistic for it, I don't know, I've decided that my place probably would be better filled, you know, writing about what I've seen. And I remember being very, very honored when Robert Coles did a review of my first book of poems, Some Deaths in the Delta, and said that poems are events, too, and that having caught some of the feel of black and white Mississippi on paper was equally valid and that it served its purpose. And I guess I'm always searching for purpose. And I've worried a lot about whether writing was taking the easy way out, but that's what I did.
The whole concept of the family has become a politicized issue, you know, with you know, quote, family values. As somebody who writes about families and about the most complex and conflicting emotions within families, what do you make of the politicization?
One of the things that I hate, Terry, is the simplification of so many complex questions. Aside from, you know, who uses this for what purpose, I really am very, very put off by the idea that this can be used as a you know, a moment for flag waving and to make this incendiary and to divide people, when in fact we know that family values are just incredibly complex. And what do we mean by that anyway? So, you know, inevitably, all my books have been devoted to trying to show how complicated our lives are. At one point, Judith, the 12-year-old, well, she's about 15 at this point, near the end of the book, talks about the word irony. She's learned how it has to do with holding two ideas in your head at the same time, you know. And I think that that devotion to complexity is one that's gone all through my work. In Civil Wars, a little boy, an 8-year-old boy, has to discover that he can like someone that he's supposed to hate for political reasons, and yet personally he thinks she's quite wonderful. And all he can do is, he actually throws up, since he's a little kid and can't express this in any other way, in his confusion, because he doesn't know how to deal with the complexity of his real life. And I think that's the reason that I hate the invocation of family values, which just bleeds out all the grays and makes everything black and white again.
Well, Rose Ellen Brown, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks a lot.
My guest has been novelist Rose Ellen Brown. Her new novel is called Before and After. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. A lot of Americans can't afford to get sick because they can't afford to pay medical bills. 35 million Americans have no health insurance, but lots of Americans who do have health insurance can barely pay for their policies. We'll talk about healthcare reform on the state level with Trish Riley, Executive Director of the National Academy for State Health Policy. Also, TV critic David Bianculli has been sorting out the good from the bad in the fall lineup, and one pile is a lot smaller than the other. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush says if managed properly, the nation's economy can double in size by the start of the next decade. Mr. Bush presented what he termed an agenda for American renewal in a speech today before the Economic Club of Detroit. Phil Denary of member station WDET reports.
President Bush says the U.S. economy is suffering because it has not yet adapted to a changing economic environment, where global competition is more important than in the past, where defense spending can no longer be counted on to boost the national economy, where lean manufacturing is required from American industry.
America will change. That's our destiny. How it will change will soon be decided. And I ask, as you consider the choice that you face, to consider carefully whose agenda for change best fits America's principles.
The president's six-point plan for renewal consisted mainly of initiatives he has advocated before, such as free trade, a capital gains tax cut, and school reform. For National Public Radio, I'm Phil Denary in Detroit.
One day after President Bush promised no new taxes ever, a White House spokesman backed away from the pledge. Yesterday, Mr. Bush appeared to give again his 1988 pledge of no new taxes. But today, White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater says the president was not making a pledge, that instead, Mr. Bush was saying what he has said before, that he would not make that mistake again. 2 years ago, the president agreed to raise taxes as part of a budget agreement with Congress. In Little Rock, Arkansas, Democratic presidential contender Bill Clinton has called President Bush's economic plan outlined today just more of the same. Ben Fry of member station KUAR reports.
Responding to President Bush's proposal to cut taxes by 1%, Governor Clinton says the president's plan contains the same ideas which haven't worked for the past 12 years. Clinton says the president's proposals would give another big tax cut to the wealthy and hardly anything to the middle class. Clinton says under the president's plan, Americans making more than $200,000 a year would get a $14,000 tax cut, while those making under $20,000 would get a $50 a year tax cut. In addition, Clinton says 30 million Medicare recipients would be forced to pay more each year for health care, millions of college students would have to pay more in interest for school loans, and more than a million disabled veterans would be removed from disability rolls. For National Public Radio, I'm Ben Fry in Little Rock.
A Senate committee has approved $7.2 billion in aid for hurricane-damaged Florida and Louisiana. At the same time, the committee killed a motion to rebuild Homestead Air Force Base destroyed by the storm. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 34 points to close at 3,305.16 in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. On Capitol Hill, the House has approved a family leave bill by a vote of 241 to 161 and sent the measure on to the White House, where the president is expected to veto. Under the measure, many employees would be granted up to 12 weeks of unpaid leave every year to care for newborn or sick children or close relatives. Leave would also be granted if workers themselves become seriously ill. The bill protects employees' jobs while on leave and requires employers to continue health insurance benefits during leave. Israelis living in the Golan Heights have reacted angrily to Prime Minister Rabin's statement that in exchange for a peace treaty with Syria, Israel is prepared for territorial compromise on the Golan. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Many of the 12,000 Israelis living in the Golan Heights see Prime Minister Rabin's statement today as the first step in a process that will end with a total Israeli withdrawal. The deputy mayor of the town of Katzrin said that once the first yard is handed over, the government will not be able to stop. A large percentage of these Israelis voted for Labor Party leader Rabin in the June election and helped assure his narrow victory. Before the election, Rabin said that Israel will never leave the Golan, a statement interpreted by those living in the area as a guarantee that Jewish settlements would never be dismantled. But recently, Rabin has refused to promise that Jewish settlements would not be included in land that could eventually be returned to Syria. The Israelis living in the Golan are planning a series of protests. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
A federal court jury in Minnesota has ruled in favor of eight current and former players in the National Football League in a key pro football verdict. The players had charged the league illegally restricted their right to free agency. The jury of eight women found that the NFL's Plan B system violated antitrust laws. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. 35 million Americans don't have health insurance. But lots of Americans who have it can barely afford to pay for it. President Bush and Governor Clinton have made health care reform important issues in their campaigns. Meanwhile, while they debate health policy on a national level, there's some interesting action on the state level, and we've invited Trish Riley to explain it to us. She's the executive director of the National Academy for State Health Policy in Portland, Maine. I asked her why the states are taking the initiative.
I think states are, at one level, frustrated by the slowness of federal action. Secondly, it's an extraordinarily complex issue, so it's natural that the federal government moves slowly and needs to consider that complexity. They themselves are purchasers of health care, and I think people forget this. State governments pay for their employees, their retirees, workers' compensation health care benefits. They see as a payer of health care, as a purchaser of health care, the inflated costs. They see it as a regulator, and they see it as the provider of programs like the Medicaid program, which has grown in the last several years to become the first or second largest single element of state budgets. Last year, the Medicaid program grew at 26%. And that's largely because in a time of recession and with some federal mandates and federal changes that have been allowed in that program, more and more people are eligible for the Medicaid program. So it's beginning to have an extraordinary impact on state budgets.
You've described the states as providing small laboratories of innovation. Can you give us an example of a state that you think has come up with an innovative, workable health insurance plan?
Well, there are a number, but I think most notable is Hawaii. It's always curious to me that when the debate turns to what we ought to do about health coverage in this country, we look to Canada or Germany. And in fact, we have a state that's done a fairly comprehensive job. In Hawaii, before a piece of federal legislation was enacted called ERISA, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, which disallowed this, Hawaii mandated that all employers in Hawaii must provide health insurance for their workers. It then went the next step, expanded the Medicaid program, which is the program for the poor, as far as it could to pick up individuals who were poor, but recognized that then there were still people who fell through the gaps, individuals who may not be employed, individuals who were not easily insurable. And they, in turn, created a state health insurance program, a state-funded program run through two insurance companies that picks up those individuals who aren't otherwise covered either by the Medicaid program or their mandated employer-based program.
Do you think that the Hawaii plan could be adapted by other states?
Not unless the federal government acts. At the moment, the federal government Hawaii's plan began before 1974. In 1974, the federal government created ERISA. Again, that's the Employee Retirement Income Security Act. And what that says is states have no authority to mandate insurance coverage, basically. So it really preempts any state from doing what Hawaii's done. A state now cannot, without violating federal law, turn to their employers and say, thou shall provide health insurance. What they can do, and this is sort of an invention of the second generation, if Hawaii is the first generation of state reform, then Massachusetts and Oregon are the second generation. Those states invented the notion of pay or play. If a state cannot have authority by federal law to require an employer to pay for health insurance, it can still control state tax policy and can say, okay, employer, I can't tell you to pay for insurance, but I can tell you that if you don't, you're going to pay some kind of tax.
Oregon had proposed a plan to basically cover everyone below poverty level, but coverage for some procedures would have been eliminated under this plan. Mm-hmm. The president rejected this plan by refusing to grant a special waiver. Let me ask you to explain what the plan was and why it was rejected by the president.
Well, the Oregon health plan is certainly more complicated than the press around this so-called rationing would make it seem. What Oregon intended to do was a very comprehensive approach. The press has tended to focus on just the limits of the plan. What they intended, currently the Medicaid program nationally provides coverage, even though it is the program for poor people. That's its design, that's its structure, that's what it's intended to do. In fact, it only pays for 40% of the nation's poor. Oregon said that's wrong. If it's a public program for the poor, it must pay for 100% of all those who are poor. So what Oregon said is they're going to turn things on their head. And instead of having a very rich, broad set of services fundable through Medicaid for 40% of poor people, they were going to create a basic benefit and make it available for everyone, all poor people. Secondly, they would say to employers, you too shall make this benefit plan available for your workers. And they too enacted a pay-or-play provision that would have required, had the federal waivers gone into effect, required employers to enact the same kind of provisions to create the same kind of basic health plan for their workers as Medicaid would have. So it was, in fact, a comprehensive approach to assure all Oregonians had health coverage. The secretary sent back the request from Oregon on the grounds that it may discriminate against persons with disabilities. It may violate the Americans with Disabilities Act. We think that creates a very serious precedent and raises some very serious concerns about health reform generally. But according to the secretary, as I understand it, he argues that when asking a community what it values in health care, there is an inherent discrimination on the part of that community to not value certain kinds of activities that a person with disabilities might. For example, the community at large may conclude that an individual with cirrhosis of the liver who is an alcoholic ought not to be treated. And indeed, in the Oregon list, that individual would not be treated, would not get certain kinds of treatments. Those who advocate that the Americans with Disabilities Act protects persons with disabilities would argue that that alcoholic is a person with disabilities, and his idea of quality of life may be fundamentally different than those of us who don't have that disability.
Do you think that the rejection of the Oregon plan is a setback for state health advances?
I think it sets a precedent that could indeed raise very serious issues of, for example, states, many, many states have now created bare-bones insurance plans. They've said, we understand that small employers have a difficult time paying for affordable health coverage. 25 states have enacted provisions that would allow those states to cover basic benefit plans, bare-bones insurance plans, stripped of mandated benefits. What that means is, in those states, in those 25 states that have enacted these plans, and 12 more are pending, they will provide to small employers a very basic benefit plan that doesn't include mental health services in many instances, that doesn't include non-therapeutic rehabilitation. So if you're a person with handicaps, physical handicaps, who needs some kind of rehab just to get through the day, but it's not going to make you any better, those services would not be paid for in many of the bare-bones plans. One could easily argue that if the secretary is correct in his Oregon decision, that those bare-bones programs are also violations. And that's currently a rage in the states, and you see many states enacting just such provisions. So I think what the Oregon decision does is raise more questions than it answers.
Mm-hmm. You know,
and the sad truth is that those people who really want to see a solution to bring equity of health care and access to health care at all and equity and access to persons with disabilities are set at each other's throats, and that's something we want very much to avoid.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Trish Riley. She's the executive director of the National Academy for State Health Policy in Portland, Maine. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about health care reform with Trish Riley, who directs the National Academy for State Health Policy. What do you think is the appropriate balance between the state and federal responsibility in the area of health insurance?
Well, I think it's certainly more than health insurance. It's we need to think not just about what kind of access, what kind of financing we have to care, but what kind of system of care is out there. And that's terribly important, because even if we somehow had a magic wand and could tomorrow create sufficient financing for health care in America, the question remains, are there enough doctors? No. Are they in the right places? No. Do we have the right kinds of facilities in the right places? No. So there's clearly a role for the states to help design the infrastructure of the health care system, to help work with the federal government in redesigning medical education. And I would argue for designing the system of care that makes sense for their states. West Virginia has problems with black lung disease. New Jersey has particular problems with HIV infection caused by drug abuse. Texas has some particular problems of on the border with migrant workers. Each state has a singular set of needs and capacities that needs to be considered in any kind of health reform.
Could we solve the health care crisis in this country on the state level?
Not alone. I think it requires to solve this problem, requires a partnership between the federal and state governments, between consumer groups, employers, providers. It requires that kind of sitting around a table to come to terms with what kind of system we want, how much we want to pay, what kind of choices we want to allow ourselves, and what kind of choices we want to restrict as a society. Regrettably, it seems to me that the debate at this point is largely each individual constituency, each individual political leader coming up with his or her own proposal. And what we need are fewer proposals and more effort to reach consensus. The Pepper Commission that was chaired by Senator Jay Rockefeller was one such effort, but people seem not yet willing to come to terms with the need to agree on a direction and set a course to achieve it.
You know, one of the really big problems, both for employers who are offering health care plans and for individuals who have to buy the plans on their own, is that they're so expensive. Do you see any possibility in the near future for decreasing the cost of having health insurance for the sake both of employers and of individuals?
Well, that clearly has to be a major part of any kind of reform effort, is how will we contain the costs and where and how. The Minnesota proposal, for example, which will create a broad publicly subsidized program for individuals who don't otherwise have insurance, pledges itself to reduce health care costs over 5 years by 10%. How they'll do that will be quite interesting. Vermont, through their global budget, intends to do the same. New York, with the attempt to relieve administrative costs through the creation of a single claims form, again, is another approach toward the same. We have lots of experiments and many questions, but I don't think we yet have a very clear conclusion about cost containment, nor is there a magic wand. It's all of those things. It's the elimination of administrative costs. It's the assurance that people receive care in a preventive manner so that they don't have expensive acute episodes that are otherwise avoidable. It's the, frankly, the need to reform medical malpractice and the litigious nature of our healthcare industry and the growing costs there. It's the necessity to consider what's an appropriate test, what's an appropriate technology, what's an appropriate use of resources. These are very tough, value-laden questions that this society has got to grapple with.
You direct the National Academy for State Health Policy, mm-hmm, in Portland, Maine. Do you get health insurance as part of your benefits?
No, we don't. We're just in the process of getting them, as a matter of fact, as we speak. We've been...
You don't have health benefits?
We've been affiliated... Well, we've been affiliated with the University of Maine, and we've been getting health benefits from them, but we're now in the process of creating our own benefit as we grow.
Uh-huh. So what are you looking for?
Well, we're actually in the same process as every small employer. We're trying to get a plan that makes sense for a workforce that's very different and very diverse. So at this point, we can't, because of the smallness of our group, we cannot get an HMO coverage, which we'd like to. Some of our workers have permanent residence out of state. So we're in the negotiating stage now, but we're leaving one insurer to pick up another one, and we fully appreciate what employers go through.
Tell me what else you're up against in trying to come up with a good plan.
Well, the issue is cost. The issue is that we have a very small group of 7 employees. Some of them get health coverage from dependents. Others have dependents who need coverage. We're trying to convert some workers from a plan that's very rich, that provides 100% dependent coverage. And, of course, the issue is affordability and quality of the health care plan. Many of these individuals are coming from large state governments and universities, which have very rich plans, and when you're a 7-person shop, it's a tough thing to negotiate for. We are, like every other small business, confronted with limited choices and expensive plans.
So you're really kind of seeing this from both sides here. You're having to deal with this as, like, the head of the group and also as somebody who needs a good policy.
That's exactly right. We see this both as advocates for states and as a small business.
Trish Riley, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Trish Riley is the executive director of the National Academy for State Health Policy in Portland, Maine. This is Fresh Air. Here's a rundown of some of the stories coming up on All Things Considered. President Bush addressed the Detroit Economic Club today. He got more specific about the tax cut he proposed at the Republican convention. The House has passed a family leave bill, but the margin wasn't enough to override a presidential veto. Environmentalists are concerned about reports that Somali leaders accepted millions of dollars from Swiss companies to dump tons of waste in Somalia. And we'll hear letters from listeners. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. There are more than 35 new TV series premiering this fall. TV critic David Bianculli has seen all but the handful that have yet to be made available for preview. To help you sort the bad from the good in the coming weeks, here are the shows he considers the best of the bunch.
Don't bother to reach for a pen. It's not a long list. This season, there are 2 big trends, and I don't like either one of them. One is a carryover from last year, more reality shows. And if you've seen NBC's new Secret Service, you already know they're even worse this year. The other trend is a widespread cloning of Fox's youth-obsessed Beverly Hills 90210. There are so many variations of that theme, Melrose Place, The Heights, Class of 96, it's hard to tell the shows apart. And frankly, it's not worth the effort. In fact, the only new series that stand out this year are the ones that don't fall into any neat categories. I've already reviewed one of the shows I like the most, ABC's Going to Extremes. It's the one about med students in the Caribbean. I also really like Picket Fences, which premieres a week from Friday on CBS. That show stars Tom Skerritt and Kathy Baker, and it's in that middle ground, somewhere between Northern Exposure and Twin Peaks. It's about a small town loaded with weird and likable characters, but it's also a town with a kind of dark undercurrent. For example, the series begins with a local stage production of The Wizard of Oz, but that stage show is stopped when the Tin Man collapses off stage.
Cut him loose! Cut him out of there!
Oh, my God!
Come on, people. Give him room.
Be careful!
Give him room now. Back off, people. Back off.
He looks blue. He's supposed to be crazy. Julia, shut up and walk away. Walk away now.
I'm just being concerned.
Talk to me, Doctor. What?
Send your audience home.
What? Send them home? We've got a show to put on. The
show's over, Joe. The Tin Man's dead.
The only other new fall series I really enjoy is Mad About You, an NBC comedy starring Paul Reiser and Helen Hunt as newlyweds in New York. It's been described as Seinfeld gets married, and that's a pretty good description. In fact, NBC has placed Mad About You right after Seinfeld, so it makes for a very compatible double feature. Mad About You premieres in a couple of weeks. Meanwhile, the reason it doesn't premiere next week is because NBC is showing a special one-hour season premiere of Seinfeld. I had more fun watching that preview tape than any of the 30-some new shows I've sat through, because the Seinfeld writers have come up with a brilliant plot line. Ever since it premiered, Seinfeld has been a minimalistic comedy, with episodes built around waiting for a table at a restaurant, looking for a car in a parking lot, or just sitting around talking. This season, the show finally has a continuing plot line. Jerry Seinfeld gets an offer from NBC executives to pitch an idea for his own TV sitcom. At first, Seinfeld doesn't know what kind of show to pitch. But then, he and his buddy George are sitting in a diner talking about such meaningless things as salsa when inspiration struck.
You know, it must be impossible for a Spanish person to order seltzer and not get salsa. I wanted seltzer, not salsa!
Don't you know the difference between seltzer and salsa? You have the seltzer after the salsa.
See, this should be the show. This is the show.
What?
Yes, just talk.
Yeah, right.
No, I'm really serious. I think that's a good idea.
Just talking? Well, what's the show about?
It's about nothing.
No story?
No, forget the story.
You gotta have a story.
Who says you gotta have a story? Remember when we were waiting for that table in that Chinese restaurant that time? That could be a TV show.
And who's on the show? Who are the characters?
I could be a character.
You?
Yeah, you base a character on me.
So on the show, there's a character named George Costanza?
Yeah. What, there's something wrong with that? I'm a character. People are always saying to me, you know, you're quite a character.
So for a while, at least, Seinfeld will be a TV show about making a TV show about nothing. As boring as that sounds, though, it's a lot more entertaining than almost all of the new TV shows that are about something.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post and author of Teleliteracy, Taking Television Seriously. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein and Sue Spolin, who also directed today's show. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Henry Kissinger, the secretive diplomat and the savvy celebrity. We'll talk with Walter Isaacson, the author of a new biography of Kissinger. Isaacson describes Kissinger as brilliant but conspiratorial, charming but deceitful. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.